ignoring the people of his state. Won't listen, won't bargain, won't negotiate. That's why there's 14 senators sneaking across the border. 14 senators, capital disorder. 14 senators, new Wisconsin heroes. What's the score? Senators 14, Governor Walker 0. Protests are growing.
Good morning and welcome to the Sarah Schultz Show, where we the people are now in session. I'd like to wish everyone a happy Labor Day weekend. If you have plans to enjoy this extended weekend, remember to thank a union member, because it was the unions that brought us weekends in the first place. So just keep that in mind as you're enjoying your extended weekend, and a well-deserved weekend off, I'm sure. This is day 79 of Hollis Malin's hunger strike. He's a gentleman in Madison who has been on a hunger strike for the treatment of vets and what's going on in Wisconsin. He is on day 79. Now, we have a great show coming up for you today. We have Barbara Wythe. She'll be on in just a second. Then Mike McCabe will be on. He's with the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. And we're going to follow up, finish the show with Michelle Wheeler from the Bad River Watershed Association. We also have WINS Network, 3-Minute World News, and the Progressive Point of View of Matt Rothschild. If you'd like to call in, the phone number is 310-742-1896. And my new toll-free number is 877-497-1797. When you call in, just give your name when you get on the show. I also have a live discussion right now on blogtalkradio.com. Actually, I'm working on getting it up. It's a little slow this morning. But once it'll be up, you can go in there and you can ask questions, and I'll be more than happy to ask them on the air for you. You could also download my show as a free podcast from iTunes or my show page at www.blogtalkradio.com/Sarah Schultz. And you can find me on my Facebook page, The Sarah Schultz Show. So I'm going to start this show off with several changes to the show and a huge announcement. I'm so excited about this announcement. But let me tell you some of the changes. Starting next week, so starting next Saturday, the show will be 2 hours long. So we're going to start at 10:30, but we'll end at 12:30. So it's 2 full hours of The Sarah Schultz Show. I will also have a couple new segments next week. The first segment will be right away. It will be right as soon as the show starts, and it's going to be called Defend Wisconsin Weekly News Roundup with Yuri Rashkin. Yuri writes a blog, the blog Defend Wisconsin News Roundup, and he's coming to talk about some of the stories that are in and around the state. Like I said, he'll be starting the show off every week, so listen for that. And I'm also going to end the show. So it's the beginning and ending of my show next week is going to change. The show is going to end with a segment called Your Thoughts. Now, I'll pick a topic from the news story or something that maybe came on Facebook that caught my attention, and I'm going to throw it out. I'll just give it to you guys. And what I want you guys to do is, as my listeners, I want you to call in and tell me your thoughts on that. It's not just you get one statement. It's going to be, give me your thoughts, give me why, a little chat, a way for you to get your voice out, get your opinions out, and be heard. So that will be the way I end my show. For the last 20 minutes or so, I'll just take your phone calls, and we'll talk about that topic. Now, and I probably should hold off the big announcement to later, but I'm so excited. I can't. I just have to get this announcement out. I am so excited that you can now hear me, The Sarah Schultz Show, in Madison on citywide WIDE-LPFM starting tonight from 6:30 to 8 p.m. I am so excited to be on citywide LPFM as a community radio station in Southwest Madison, and their website is www.citywidelpfm.org. So they've got some great shows on there, mine's included. Listen in tonight, 6:30 to 8 p.m. Very excited. That was my big announcement. I will be on the radio in Madison. Now, going on, I have a little something that might interest you regarding, Senator Rich Zipperer. Now, a couple weeks ago, Senator Zipperer said he would help anyone who couldn't get an ID to get one. Now, this is a news story, and you can find it. I will post this on my Facebook page, but it's found at brookfield.wi.patch.com/articles/Zipperer-stands-behind-voter-ID-law. Very long. I promise I'll get that on the Facebook page. No problems. But someone actually took him up on his offer. So they sent a memo out, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to read you the memo that this person sent. It's He sent it out for his mother. So let me start out the memo that I received. So Senator Zipperer, right before pointing to his forehead and freezing his little brain, said, this is the memo. I probably should have not said that, but that's okay. We can see where this person's already at. Any constituent or anyone in the state, if there's an individual with a legal right to vote, have them contact me or my office. I will make sure they get properly registered and have an ID. If you know any individual, bring them to my attention. Even if they don't live in the 33rd Senate District, I'll get them to the office of their senator, quote. That was his quote from the Brookfield Patch article I mentioned earlier. So this person called Zipperer's staff members, and he explained his grandparents' situation, disenfranchisement. He, now, quoting the memo, he took their information and said he would pass along to Senator Vanguard, which is this person's grandparents' senator. I asked him what Senator Vanguard would do. He said he would put them in touch with the local DMV. I reminded him that going to the DMV is the problem, and that putting him in touch with the DMV was hardly necessary as they're in the phone book. I asked if they were going to need to go to the DMV, and he said yes. I asked how that was going to resolve the problem, and he said he didn't know. I asked if transportation would be provided, and he said he didn't know. I said, well, in this case, transportation isn't an issue. Waiting at the DMV is. But what about other people who didn't have transportation? How would they be helped? He said he didn't know. Now, he is Zipperer's staff member. The I is the gentleman who wrote this memo. I said that some people who are in wheelchairs or have disabilities need specialized transportation. Would the senators be making arrangements and paying for that? He said he didn't know. So that is the response to with Senator Zipper, the gentleman who came on the record and said, I will help anyone who needs an ID get an ID, when actually asked how he can help people. The people who need the transportation, not the fact that they're at the DMV or getting to the DMV, it's staying at the DMV, it's being there for an hour or two or how long it's going to take them to get there, depending on where they're at. And what if the drive is an hour or two to get to the DMV? You know, these are the answers they don't have. So I guess it was a nice thought. My opinion, that those words are a little hollow. He just said it to say it. Obviously, he supports the bill, and that's where he's going to stay. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to go to Barbara, who's been patiently waiting while I read that memo for you. Good morning, Barbara.
Good morning, Sarah. Thanks for having me this morning.
Oh, you're welcome. This is Barbara West. She is releasing her sixth book called Steal This Book, Not My Vote. You're from La Pointe, Wisconsin, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
All right.
La Pointe.
It's way, way up north. I'm way at the other end of the state. So, well, I'd like to say welcome to the Sarah Schultz Show. If you have any questions for Barbara, please call 310-742-1896 or toll free at 877-497-1797. Now, I mentioned your book, Steal This Book, Not My Vote. That's coming out on September 21st, and we're going to get to that at the end of it. But I really want to talk about your fifth book, Guerrilla Publishing.
Yes, I'm so excited, and I'm really excited to weave that into what's going on in Wisconsin right now. How we as a state kind of have to use the every resource that we have to get out the real news. And like you have taken up the airwaves, and thank you so much. I think so much of this information is being moved on smaller levels, on grassroots levels. Very important when the major media isn't covering us. So I decided to take my gift of publishing. I've been publishing since 1997, and as you say, I have six books out, and actually use it to get information about what's going on in Wisconsin out there, and we can talk about that book later. But I really think this is a time for all of you out there who are writers and thinking about writing, or even photographers, because so much great photography has come out of this, to document it historically and get it published. And my fifth book does indeed share this the system that I've developed over years of researching all of the companies of how to set up a simple system that's cost effective that will allow you to publish and distribute books, printed material.
Well, I was you were kind enough to send me a copy of it, and I was able to go through it a little bit. And you've got it split into three sections, which I think is great. You've got writing, publishing, and then selling. And that's kind of how my questions are going to be given to people so it can follow the book. So when you go pick up the Guerrilla Publishing book, you'll see the sections. She's got three chapters on each. So I'm going to start out with writing. Now, at the Democracy Convention, you know, there was a lot of emphasis on getting out and getting things done. And that's, like I said, is where your book starts. How can people start writing a book or finish a book that they started?
Well, I take a little bit different approach under the writing section. You know, this isn't writing skills. This is answers that very question. And part of what people can't understand is that once you know exactly how you're going to publish your book, it gives you the impetus to go, wow, this is so doable. How can I get my book published? And then it's a matter of organization, because so many times, you know, well, I'm going to write, I'm going to do this, I'm going to sit down, I'm going to write that. And then, you know, you're driving by, you know, the store and you stop and there's your writing time is gone. And so my approach is helping people organize their lives for the finite period until you finish your book. And it is a finite period. You don't have to live this way the rest of your life. You just have to watch less TV. You have to organize time and thought and intention into it. So I cover those kinds of things to help people. But trust me, when people see how easy it is to get it published and own everything and have all the control, they're so motivated.
Is that the key to being motivated, is knowing that, you know, I can get this done and there's really a way to get published? It's not a shot in the dark anymore?
I think for most people, I think there are some of us, I think I have been completely creatively driven all my life, which is why I'm not necessarily, you know, cash rich, because my value has been exercising my creativity, which then produces books and, you know, all the stuff that I'm doing. But for the average person, it's such a huge hurdle in your mind, you know, when you're faced in those moments where you want to slough it off because, well, you know, how am I going to do this anyway? Da, da, da. No, now you have a commitment and a process that you know. It's like project management. So, yes, it helps a great deal.
And one of the things that writers have the hardest time with, at least that's what I'm told, I'm not a big writer, but writer's block. How do you get around writer's block?
Well, I have a few techniques I use. First of all, I usually have two writing projects going at once. Because when I get blocked over here, then I can go over this one, which might, you know, get the... Because it's just about energy flowing. It's not that you really don't have the ideas in you. It's that, you know, there are ebbs and flows of writing that if you go with them and don't resist them... In fact, I don't even like that term, writer's block. I just think there's patterns that you have that you go with, and you have little tricks. One is for me to have two projects going so I keep interested in one or the other. Another is stop. Give yourself permission not to have to write. In fact, tell yourself you're not permitted to write, you know, and then you want to write. There's a lot of things you can do. It makes it fun, I think.
So with getting organized, is that kind of, again, it seems to come back to just being organized and ready to sit down and organize your life to write.
Well, I think there's a commitment that has to be made. You know, it's hard because, believe me, my first book I wrote with two other people, it took us 4 years. This new book is going to take me about 6 weeks. So there's, you know, you have to understand that you have to be committed to it, and even if you sort of fall off the commitment, you take it up again, and then... There's also the just a mindfulness that you've made this commitment to finish this book, that you can finish it, that you're going to have some challenges, and you're going to prepare for those challenges in ways that, you know, are helpful, and then you're going to just go do it. And I personally think the achievement is what I get high on, is when I get the book done, and now I've done this. Oh, my gosh, the self-esteem, and then the work that the book does, it's so rewarding. And I think once somebody goes through their first project and faces all those fears of their first book, maybe you're like me, and then you go, wow, I can write anything now. You know, I can publish anything I want. Nobody can stop me. Nobody can tell me to pipe down or change the cover, and it's amazing. So very exciting work.
Well, it's nice you put so much effort and energy into doing something. It's just nice to have a finished copy that you can look at and say, look what I did.
Oh, the book, no matter how much you read the manuscript on paper or on your computer, when you get that book in your hands, it reads different the first time you crack that cover and you see, oh my gosh, I'm a published author now. And it is a tremendously rewarding experience. And I hope I can inspire all those people at the Democracy Convention in particular, because this is the history. This is the knowledge we need right now to be publishing, because nobody's publishing it.
Well, that's a good segue, because I was just going to go into publishing. Why should people know this information?
I think publishing is one of the least understood and most it's in such a transformation right now, even now. The people don't know how much they don't know about the world of publishing. And there's the traditional publishing, the random houses, the big houses, which are all falling by the big corporate wayside. You know, big box bookstores are not doing so well these days. And then there's the online publishing, the iUniverse, the Ex Libris. And this is a whole entirely new animal that I will warn everybody off of. To do so much research into what that is giving you against what you could get if you just knew the steps of publishing. It's so much simpler than any of those industries make it, and they actually feed off how much you don't know. And that's what my book in publishing tries to help people educate you on: what is really needed, what does the publisher actually do, how can you accomplish these things, and once you see how easy it is for you to do it in this way, it makes you understand. I mean, people will still want to get signed with major publishers, and people will still want to use iUniverse, but to be armed with the knowledge of this industry that's very complicated. It's a very complicated industry.
Well, what's the easiest way to get published?
Well, I think my guerrilla publishing process is it's the least expensive. You get all the control completely. You get international online distribution, wherein the distributor will pull up all the... I'm on the Amazon.com Germany sites and the Italy sites, and when people buy from those sites, they go right to my distributor, and at the end of the month, they put a check in my account. It's really... And I get to keep all control of everything. Now, do I have to hire out assistants for promotion and marketing? Yeah, but... Truthfully, unless you're on the upper echelon of publishing, there's many different reasons you publish and ways to sell your book that are non-traditional. So there's a lot of things to consider when looking at it. But I do believe that I've honed the system down to, and most of the people I've helped get it up online, because I help people do that, all agree. You know, wow, who knew? It's like, I know, that's why I wrote the book.
Well, if I asked what some of the steps in publishing are, would that be giving too much of the book away?
Publishing in which area? Mine, the traditional, or the online?
Pick the easiest way people could get published and just go through the basic steps of that one.
Okay, no, that's not giving away anything. First of all, you have to finish your manuscript. get a lot of editing on it and proofing, because believe me, as we go through this process, you'll always find more things to prove. So get it done as possible. You put it in a graphics file, which is just book designers, or you could do it. I always, encourage people to learn how to do it so they can do it themselves from here on in. That's what I do. And you create an account with my distributor, printer, and... Once you have that account, which doesn't cost anything, it costs you about $75 to upload your files, and then $12 a year for them to put up the international distribution sites, and then you're done with that, with those two parts. Now you have to go sell them, and that's another conversation. But to be able to then have your friends go to Amazon and order your book and pay for it, or your own website, you buy books for cost. There's no markup on them. The cost of printing plus shipping for you, the publisher. That's it.
What's the one thing people should know about publishing that they don't?
Oh, I think people need to research online publishing very, very closely before you go with any online publisher. There's big traps in there, and we can go into some of the details of what they are. But what I would suggest is, what I did was I put something in the basket, like I ordered the, I want this book package, where you get this and this and this. I put it in the cart, went to pay for it, and then there's those terms and conditions that you have to check before you can check out. Well, I printed those out and read the fine print, and I was mortified. Things like, if you cancel this contract within 6 months of us publishing you, you're going to owe us another $1,500 for what we're calling file fees. These are things people don't read, and maybe it never becomes an issue because, they don't go far enough with their book career, which is, I suppose, what they're hoping for. But just read the really fine print on the online publisher.
Now, your book talks about print on demand. Do you want to talk a minute about that? That kind of grabbed my attention.
Yeah. Now, when I first published my first book in 1997, print on demand was just an idea. So when I went to put that book out, I had to go to an offset printer, and they printed 12 up, and they cut them and all that. Print-on-demand is where they have the technology to print one book at a time, and you can get volume discounts, but you can also print one book for a very, very, very cost-effective price. While on an offset, the setup charges for the press and the way they lay out the paper and all that, you can't really get a book printed. So this has revolutionized the printing industry greatly, because now you don't have to have big supplies of books on hand. Every order that comes to an Amazon.com site for my book will go directly to my printer distributor. They'll print the one book, they'll send it on, and put the money in my account. So it's really an exciting, exciting technology.
Is it used a lot by people? Is it something that is? You said it was just a thought in 97. Is this something that just came out? Is it something that is something people need to use more?
I think probably all of the online publishers are print on demand. Lulu, Exlibris, iUniverse, CreateSpace. That's what the basis of the industry. That industry is, yes.
And is there any other way that you can publish that makes it easy for people to get their voices heard? You've talked about online, you got to watch out for that. You've talked about the way you do it. I guess a regular publisher then, is that the other option?
Yes, and that process is a much more laborious and kind of shot in the dark. Publishing companies don't have a lot of money anymore to pay advances. They've cut down so many of their services, their marketing services, but it isn't impossible. I have several friends who are signed, especially business writers, with Josie Bass, which is a very reputable, high-selling, traditional publisher of business books that if somebody was in that genre could certainly submit and get chosen. But you have to remember, once you go with a publisher, what you're doing is you're saying, I own this work, but I give you the right to do absolutely anything that you think you want to do with it. So you have to be prepared to have the cover not be yours, to have them change the text and edit it into what they want. They can change the title. And that isn't necessarily, there are many, many, many authors published traditionally that are very, very happy with their publishers. But in this day and age, for what we need, especially in Wisconsin, to document the history, there's other ways of manufacture and distribution outside those non-traditional channels.
So basically, once the publisher gets it, they can edit and change what they want with your book to make it more marketable in their opinion.
Yes, and that isn't necessarily a bad thing. My work is so specific that I just wouldn't trust anybody to change it. So, and I'm a control freak, and I just think my way works very, very well for me outside the traditional field. So, I don't want to downgrade the traditional industry, but it is true, you know, that's what you do is give up your rights. So,
well, some people like that, and some people say, no, hands off, it's all mine, and I'm going to do it my way. So,
exactly.
That's why you have your book out there.
Yes.
Right. Now, I want to talk a few minutes. I want to finish this talking about guerrilla publishing by discussing some ways you can sell your book. You've got it. You've got it out. You're going to go publish it. How do you get your book out to people?
Well, there's all sorts of ways. One is you can always hire somebody to do it for you because there's people in the industry that do just that. They market your book. So, you know, you take some off the profits, of course, but you still have control. So you won't be making as much per book, but you might be selling more books. Events, live events, speaking engagements. I always encourage people when they write the book to consider the presentation that they'll give, whether it's a book signing or, you know, maybe you've written a historical art fiction novel that you're going to go talk to the art societies and try to sell your books in that way. There's also your own online research, you know, the chat rooms that you're in, Facebook, the social media that you're doing, writing groups, associations that would be interested in your topic. It gets really fun after a while if you're not pressured to have to sell. You just have this book. There's no inventory sitting there for you to feel like, oh, my gosh, I got to sell. And then you can free up to kind of follow your creative juices when it comes to marketing as well.
So basically use what you have and reach out to those you think the book would interest.
Yeah, it puts a whole different expectation than if you, say, sign with a traditional publisher. They're going to expect you to get out there and sell, or they're going to take your book off the shelf. And to me, that pressure was too much. So this way, you're not pressured. It's more like fun. I hated marketing. You know, I was an artist, consummate artist. Somebody else sell. But now I just see it as an outreach. Like I'll be at the Fighting Bob Fest with my new book, and that's a great place to sell. And I can talk about the mission of the book as well. And you got to get creative. Guerrilla, you know, the whole point is use what resources you have on hand sort of to make it kind of like what we're doing in Wisconsin.
I was going to say, that's the entire state, basically. We're doing what we can with what we have. Now, talking about Fighting Bob Fest in your new book, we have a couple minutes left. I really want you to talk a little bit more about Steal This Book, Not My Vote, which, again, comes out September 21st. Can you give an idea, premise of what the book's about?
Yes. I was an observer at the Supreme Court recount, and we found so much evidence of possible fraud, certainly enough to cast reasonable doubt that it was an open and fair election. And since then, this group has emerged, and as Wisconsin does, you know, it's morphed into different arms of an organization to bring reform to election systems. And, of course, I've been on the barricades with everybody else since February when the Dems left. And I finally got to a point where I filed a suit with the Department of Justice. I called them, and they invited me. And I wrote, using my writing talents and my vision, a outline for a RICO complaint, racketeering, organized crime complaint, rather than just election fraud. And someone urged me to put it in a book so that people could really read it to get a vision of what's really going on in the state. So it's expanded to become the rationale for why I think the racketeering should go 10 years back and include the voting machine companies and et cetera. But it certainly does name the Republicans in the state as defendants, as I've watched them with election fraud and now the legislative fraud of ALEC, you know, the media fraud we all know, judicial fraud, you know, it's all here in this state. So that's what my book is about, and then it's an action plan for how we're going to take it back and restore it. I'm very excited about it, and it'll be the quickest book I ever got out in my life, probably 6 weeks from the time I started writing it to where I had, you know, copies in my hand, and we're going to go from there and get some attention for the state.
That sounds awesome. Now, Pete, for anyone who's interested in picking up either the Guerrilla Publishing or your new book when it comes out, where can they go for that?
www.barbarawith, BarbaraWith.com. I haven't started put up any of the promo. You're my first media source of advertising the book, but I'm going to get that up today and start pre-sales and have a special Fighting Bob special that will you won't have to pay shipping because you can just come and visit me and I'll give you your signed book and we'll go from there.
So you're going to have a booth then at Fighting Bob Fest as well?
I'm going to be a part of the Wisconsin Counts booth, which is all of us who came out of the recount to protect democracy, the Wisconsin Citizens for Election Protection and the Wisconsin Election Defense Alliance. We're going to have some voting machines there so you can see what we're talking about, and we're all going to join forces to keep educating the state about how we need election reform.
All right, so if you want Barb's books, the new ones that you could get at the Fighting Bob Fest, you see her there at the Wisconsin Counts booth, or go to www.barbarawith.com and order your Guerrilla Publishing or pre-order her new book. Well, thank you so much for coming on today, Barbara. Good luck with your book, and hopefully we'll get you back on again to talk more about the election issues that we have in Wisconsin.
Oh, well, we got a lot of topics we could talk about there, Sarah, but thanks so much for having me on today, and keep up this great work, and congratulations on expanding your territory.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. I'm very excited.
Okay, I'm going to hop off, and I'll listen to you online.
All right, sounds good. Have a good day, Barbara.
You too, Sarah. Thanks.
Bye. Bye. That was Barbara Wythe. She is from La Pointe, Wisconsin, who is an amazing published author and activist. So, amazing woman, Wisconsin's very own. Very excited to have her on. Now, before Mike McCabe comes on, because he's next, you're going to be hearing the WIN 3-Minute Newscast.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. It's back to school season, and AFSCME President Gerald McEntee has a math lesson for state and local governments. You can't add by subtracting. A U.S. Census report shows state and local governments eliminated 203,321 public sector jobs between March of 2009 and March of 2010. Since the 2008 Great Recession, 620,000 local and state public jobs have been wiped out. McEntee says America needs jobs and we can't add jobs by subtracting them. McEntee says regular Americans in communities coast to coast are paying the economic price, and it's long past time that politicians put the nation's economic well-being ahead of their penchant for political games. McEntee is calling for a robust jobs program big enough to truly revitalize Main Street. Wisconsin school districts are starting to feel the fallout in the wake of a law that takes away collective bargaining rights for teachers while increasing the cost of benefits. Jesse Russell reports.
The number of teachers retiring this year is double what it was the same time last year. Nearly 5,000 teachers are hanging up their teaching caps. One of the concerns for both school districts and fellow educators is one that's being echoed throughout Wisconsin's public sector, the loss of institutional memory. When there's a mass exodus of experienced employees all at once, the result is a reinvention of the wheel. The novice employees don't have the veterans to ask for advice on the most efficient way to work within the system. In the terms of education, that means a lack of veteran educators who can mentor young teachers on how to cope with a complicated classroom situation. A specific concern of the non-retiring teachers is whether or not the retirees will be replaced. In Beloit, Wisconsin, for example, they had 60 teachers retire, and only 40 were hired as replacements. That could result in larger classroom sizes being forced on inexperienced teachers. The ability to bargain over limits on how many students should be in a class is one of the rights lost when Governor Scott Walker's law was put into place.
How bad is it out there for American workers? A new Center for Law and Social Policy report shows that there are 5 job seekers for every single available job opening. 4.5 million workers have been jobless for a year or longer. Over 30% of part-time workers actually want to be full-time. Just 58% of the U.S. population is employed, and that is the lowest level since 1983. The Center for Law and Social Policy says that stimulus and jobs programs like the Workforce Investment Act helped millions find work in 2010. It's urging more investment and getting Americans back to work. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary for Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Well, now I'd like to welcome Mike McCabe from the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. Welcome to the Sarah Schultz Show, Mike.
Hi, Sarah. It's good to be with you.
Well, thanks for being on. If you have any questions for Mike McCabe, please call in at 310-742-1896 or toll free at 877-497-1797. Now, for those who don't know about the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, I can talk today, really. Can you tell people what you do and why it's important?
Well, we're first and foremost a nonpartisan watchdog group. We specialize in tracking the money in state politics in Wisconsin and helping people follow that money trail and connect the dots between the campaign contributions that go to state officials and the policy decisions that they make to reward those campaign donors. So we do a lot of research showing the impact of money in, on public policy making. And then we also advocate for reform, campaign finance reform and other kinds of reform. And I guess the bottom line for us, the common thread that runs through our efforts is the idea of trying to make a system where people matter more than money in politics.
Well, I think a lot of this started, started early on, but I think Citizens United really brought a lot of this to the forefront. Could you talk a little bit about Citizens United and how that ruling changed the game for elections and for the way money is used in the U.S.?
Well, the Citizens United decision, a little bit over a year and a half ago, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in a case brought by a conservative organization called Citizens United that corporations and other interest groups can spend unlimited amounts of money in election campaigns. There can be no limit placed on what corporations spend on their efforts to try to influence elections. And so what that ruling did is it opened the floodgates. It opened new channels through which money that had been restricted or limited could flow freely. And so it clearly has led to even more campaign spending, and we already were seeing outlandish amounts of money spent in campaigns in Wisconsin and, of course, at the federal level. Well, this just opened the floodgates wider. The other thing that the Citizens United decision did that people don't talk a lot about is it led to a decline in disclosure, less transparency in how money is spent in campaigns. Before, what we had were regulated sources of money that were being spent on campaigns. Well, now with Citizens United, corporations can spend out of their general treasuries. A lot of the money is channeled or funneled to phony front groups. There are ways now that can lead to more secret spending and keeping the public in the dark about where this money is really coming from. And so that's really the essence of the Citizens United ruling. But I have to say that the Citizens United ruling was really the second of three Supreme Court rulings that represent sort of an unholy trinity in campaign finance jurisprudence. And what these rulings have effectively done is radically reinterpret the First Amendment, and they've effectively taken the R out of free speech. And it really started in 1976 with a ruling in a case called Buckley versus Vallejo, where the court ruled, in effect, that money is speech. Well, after ruling that money talks, in Citizens United about a year and a half ago, they ruled that money can talk as much as it wants, that you can place no limit on what corporations and special interest groups spend on elections. And then just this year, in a case called Arizona Free Enterprise Club versus Bennett, which was a challenge to Arizona's wonderful public financing system, what the court effectively ruled is that not only does money talk, and money can talk as much as it wants, but that money should do all the talking, because any public effort to counter the spending by corporations and outside interest groups can't be countered with additional public financing to candidates to help them get a word in edgewise, that that public financing program in Arizona, the extra money that they would give to candidates who came under attack by special interest groups, was a violation of the free speech rights of those corporations and interest groups. That's bizarre logic, that Arizona's law didn't restrict any spending, it didn't limit what interest groups could spend. It just gave extra money, public funds, to candidates to keep them competitive, to allow them to counter the attacks that they faced. And what it really did is created more speech. Well, creating more speech was judged by the U.S. Supreme Court to be a violation of the free speech of those corporations and interest groups. That really was the completion of what I would consider an unholy trinity of campaign finance jurisprudence, radically reinterpreting the First Amendment and effectively taking the R out of free speech.
How does that work with the Feingold-McCain law, the finance reform that they put out there?
What Citizens United did was overturned a very important part of the McCain-Feingold law. What remains standing in the McCain-Feingold law is the ban on so-called soft money, where members of Congress were sitting on Capitol Hill and they were soliciting unlimited size contributions, $100,000, $200,000, $500,000 contributions in what has been called in campaign finance vernacular soft money. And the McCain-Feingold law banned that. That ban is still in effect. That's the one last piece of McCain-Feingold that remains standing. But the idea that corporations ought to have to actually disclose their spending and operate out of regulated PACs, where the contributions to that PAC are limited and the spending is totally transparent, that part of the law was overturned, was tossed in the dumpster by the U.S. Supreme Court. So what the court has done, both in the Buckley versus Vallejo ruling in 1976 and then Citizens United last year, Arizona Free Enterprise Club this year, what they've done is they've legislated from the bench. They've simply rewritten campaign finance law to favor those who have huge amounts of wealth and give them the ability to do most all the talking.
Well, and how do super PACs fall into this?
Well, you know, what we've seen over the course of the last 30 years is one innovation after another by those who are trying to buy politicians and own our government. And there keep being these new wrinkles, these new innovations that crop up to try to get around any kind of restriction or limitation. And most recently, since Citizens United, what you've got is basically the U.S. Supreme Court writing new law and rewriting the First Amendment to say that corporations are people and that corporations can spend as much as they want. They have unlimited First Amendment free speech rights, and they can spend as much as they want. So now the goal is to try to create a situation where not only can they pour unlimited amounts of money into elections, but they can also hide it from public view. And so what you see is this continuing evolution and innovation to try to create new ways of being able to dump money into accounts but shield them from public view. And one of the, you know, for a while everybody was talking about 527s, that 527s are taking over politics, and that everybody talked about them. And before that, everybody talked about PACs. Well, you know, 527s, those are just political committees named after the section of the Internal Revenue Code that they're established under, Section 527 of the IRS Code. Well, they've basically become passé. They were dominant just a few election cycles ago. They were huge instruments that were used to flood money into elections. Now they're passé. Now they've basically been thrown aside, and now you see these new super PACs and issue ad groups. And what they all basically are party fronts or interest group fronts that are receptacles for huge contributions, massive donations by wealthy interests. The money is pooled and kind of sort of gathered together, and then it's spent to influence elections, to buy politicians, and to own our government. And you know, it's the latest wrinkle, the latest innovation in the emergence of plutocracy in our country. And so now everybody's talking about super PACs. And Stephen Colbert, I think, just to try to show what an outrageous sham this is, he established his own super PAC. And you know, the system's such a joke that maybe it just takes jokes to expose it and to ultimately serve as the corrective here. But you know, I think what Colbert's doing is brilliant and just showing what a sham all this is, where wealthy people and wealthy corporations are able to pour money into an account, it gets spent on elections, and yet the public is kept entirely in the dark about who supplies the money. And so you don't know who's sponsoring this advertising. You know, it could be Walmart, it could be the Koch brothers, it could be anybody and from anywhere. And that's what Citizens United has done. It's not only opened new channels through which political money can flow more freely, but it's also led to a precipitous decline in disclosure, where way more of this campaign advertising is being funded through anonymous sources, and the donors are able to, you know, I think the politicians know who's supplying the money, and the donors certainly know who they are. The only people who are kept in the dark are average voters, the general public, and that's I think one of the real travesties of the current campaign finance system is that all of the election campaigning, all of the advertising is being paid for by less than 1% of the population. That's one of the astonishing statistics. You count up all the money that's going in there and try to trace it back to its source. All of the campaign advertising is being paid for by less than 1% of the population. And many of those donors are being kept anonymous, and so they can buy our government without their identities being known. And of course, then you look at public policy and you see tax policy being warped to put more money in the pockets of the top 1%. And so, you know, that's exactly what's happening in our system. You're seeing the rich get richer. You're seeing the super rich get spectacularly more wealthy. You're seeing the middle class stuck in a rut or sort of gradually disappearing. And you're seeing the poor get poorer. And it's a direct byproduct of the way we pay for elections in this country. Less than 1% pay for the elections, less than 1% then clean up after the election because they get all the favors, all the tax breaks, all the benefits back from the politicians that they put in office.
And you're seeing that. I mean, Wisconsin is a good example of what's going on with that, and you're going to start seeing more of those bills in the U.S. Congress.
We're seeing it every day in Wisconsin, and we're seeing it every day in Congress. You know, in Wisconsin here, we were told for months that the state was broke, that we didn't have any money, that the budget was busted, and yet they somehow found the way to provide hundreds of millions of dollars in new corporate tax breaks. We were told that we were broke, and $900 million had to be cut from aid to public schools, and money had to be cut from health care programs like Badger Care and Senior Care and Family Care, which helps senior citizens and disabled people and the poor. And those programs had to get cut. And yet they found the money to create a 15% increase for road construction. Well, it just so happens Scott Walker's the number one recipient of road builder contributions. And the road builders have poured huge amounts of money into the coffers of state legislators as well. Then we see all of these wind projects being killed. You know, the kind of green energy projects that could create new jobs and stimulate economic development and help us eventually become more independent of foreign oil, and yet the Walker administration has been killing one wind energy project after another. Well, you look at the money flowing in from the Koch brothers who have oil refineries and power plants among their major holdings. You look at all the money from those kinds of industries, and you look at the road builders. They didn't want a train going from Milwaukee to Madison, And, you know, they want to keep people in cars. They want to keep money being used for paving roads. And so Wisconsin threw away $800 million in federal funds for that train project that would have created hundreds of jobs, would have stimulated economic development from Milwaukee to Madison, all along the interstate there in places like Oconomowoc and Johnson Creek. And all of that was thrown away because of the influence of those who put people like Scott Walker in office. Their selfish interests are being well served, but I think the general public's interests are and the interests of the whole state of Wisconsin are being sold out.
All right. Before we get to the caller, what I want to do is go back a second and try to, because you gave a lot of information about super PACs and about the with United Citizens United. So let me make sure I'm getting the full picture here. The super PACs are a way for a whole bunch of rich people or a whole bunch of people to throw their money together, and then they can use the money, the pool of money the super PAC gets, to front these fake groups that go out and put out stuff for the elections.
Correct. And they can do it in a way that also conceals the true origins of all that money from public view. And so, you know, they're really able to do two things. They're able to pull all this money together to fund these front groups that do all this campaign advertising, but they're able to do it in a way that keeps the origins of the money concealed. The donors remain anonymous.
So the front groups don't have to tell you who's backing or anything. They just say, this is, you know, I'm just going to make something up. This is a front for children who want private education. And they don't tell you any information about anything else other than that there's maybe an ad out there saying, ad brought to you by children who want private education.
Yeah, you look at the Senate recall elections that we've just had in Wisconsin, and people were seeing all these ads from groups with names like American Federation for Children and Club for Growth Wisconsin. And you know, there were countless groups and on both sides that you know, have these names kind of that sound, you know, either sort of very homey or very patriotic, and those are just front groups that are, you know, Club for Growth, for example, just to give you one tangible example. As best we can tell, monitoring the TV advertising that's been done, Club for Growth spent somewhere in the neighborhood of $10 million influencing these Senate recall elections. We've only been able to identify two contributions to Club for Growth. One was a $250,000 contribution from a Texas oil man by the name of Trevor Reese Jones, and the other was a $150,000 donation that we were able to unearth from Citadel, which is a securities and asset management firm with offices in places like Chicago and New York and San Francisco and London and Hong Kong. So Wisconsin Club for Growth is hardly a homegrown organization. This is not a bunch of people in Wisconsin who are banding together to try to influence campaigns. And they were able to spend upwards of $10 million. And so far, we've only been able to identify two of the sources of some of that money, a Texas oil man and an international asset management and securities firm, and that's the $400,000 of upwards of $10 million. So that's what I'm really talking about. You've got a group with sort of an innocuous sounding name, and they're being bankrolled by wealthy out-of-state interests, and they come in and they basically try to buy these Senate recall elections.
Well, let me get to the caller. She's been patiently holding. Hello, caller. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. First of all, thanks, Mike, for what you're doing. Really good to hear that you're out there watching. One of the things that I wanted to put the piece in the puzzle is that on the election integrity end of things, we've been looking, of course, for a decade or more, people investigating these voting machines and the election fraud. And when you put the piece in of how the elections can be gamed and that now over the course of all this, they have actually, I believe, illegally, you know, fraudulently manipulated elections to get these right-wing people all across the country in 2011. But pertaining to Wisconsin, what I'm looking into, I have wondered where the money trail went from Ron Johnson, who has ties, you know, crony ties in his family to the international mining community, Rio Tinto in Australia, that owns Kennecott in Utah, that did Flambeau, which I think is still under an environmental lawsuit. But I've been often wanting to see if I could find the money around that and then how it might tie into the manufacture of these fraudulent voting machines, since Berquist, one of them, is actually a Minnesota-based company, and they would require silver to make the machine. So it's kind of a big, insidious network, and thanks for helping to uncover where that goes.
My pleasure. We've been concerned about ballot integrity and the way votes are counted for a long time, and we actually pushed for a paper trail bill in Wisconsin, and we got it signed into law several years ago. So there is a law in Wisconsin that requires any electronic voting machine to be able to produce a verifiable paper record. The problem that has cropped up just in the last year, and particularly I think came into very sharp focus in this spring's Supreme Court election, is that a paper trail law is only as good as its enforcement. And if we don't have state officials who are diligent and credible and reliable in enforcing that law and making sure that there's verifiable results, then, you know, we're still in deep trouble. So Wisconsin does have some really legitimate problems when it comes to ballot counting and election integrity. And so I tip my cap to you for caring about that, because not enough people do care about it. As for Ron Johnson, you know, I can't speak directly to the possible source of money that you're identifying. But one of the things I can say about Ron Johnson is that he put close to $10 million of his own money into the campaign, but then after the election had his company, Packer, which is basically a plastics company, pay him back in a huge payment afterwards. So effectively what you had was that corporation paying for the lion's share of the Johnson for Senate campaign. Now, you know, it's being looked at, but it appears so far that the Federal Elections Commission may not put its foot down here, in which case what you'd have is effectively a money laundering kind of an operation being approved or given a stamp of approval by the Federal Election Regulation Agency. You know what? All anybody would have to do if they run a big corporation is just, you know, take their own money, dump it into the campaign, and then have the corporation pay them back after the election. And they're not out a dime, and they're sitting in some public office basically because the corporation paid them to be there. That's the kind of thing that we're seeing now, and I think the Johnson campaign was one of those really flagrant examples of corporate influence put on steroids.
Hey, well, thanks for calling. If you are going to call in, I just want to let people know that the phone number is 310-742-1896, or the toll-free number is 877-497-1797. When you do call in, make sure you press 1 so you get in the queue. If you just want to listen to the show on your phone, don't press 1. You just listen. But if you want to talk, you have a question, make sure you press 1. You can get into the queue. All right. Now, how did all that extra money affect us in Wisconsin?
Well, you know, I think the short answer is what I said before. We're seeing a tiny fraction of the population paying for all the election campaigning. They're effectively buying the politicians. They, by extension, then end up owning our government. And then they're repaid handsomely for their campaign support. We've done a whole series of reports at the Democracy Campaign looking at big donors, the big sources of money in elections in Wisconsin, and then looking at what they get in return, what they're lobbying for, and what they're ultimately receiving. And what we've found, on average, is that the wealthiest donors that pour all this money into elections in Wisconsin are getting back $100 on average for every dollar that they put into elections. You can't get that kind of rate of return in the best bull market on Wall Street. We looked at $50 million worth of campaign contributions, and we looked at who gave that $50 million, and what we found is that they got $5 billion back in tax breaks, in pork barrel spending projects, no-bid contracts for government work. They got $5 billion worth of benefits. That's $100 back for every dollar that they put in. That's what we're getting. That's what this money is doing to our political process and ultimately to our government. And we're all paying for that as taxpayers. So what kills me is when I run into people who oppose public financing of elections and they say, well, I don't think taxpayers should pay for elections. You know, I don't think we should have socialized campaigning or welfare for politicians. And it, you know, I consider that to be just a horribly naive view. We're always going to, the public will always pay for elections one way or the other. What we're doing right now is we're paying for elections by subsidizing all of the rewards, all of the favors that the wealthy donors get. So less than 1% pay for the elections. They get $100 back for every dollar that they put in, and the $100 comes at our expense. We all pay for that as taxpayers. That's what's happening to our government. And you know, we had these recent recall elections. $40 million is our best guess so far. We're still tallying it up. We're still counting it. We're probably a couple of weeks away from being able to put out something with putting a pretty specific price tag on these elections. But it's going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of $40 million in just 9 Senate recall elections. And you know, most of the money was not spent by the candidates. The candidates were out. We had record spending by 2 candidates, Alberta Darling in Milwaukee, Dan Kopanky in La Crosse, spent more than had ever been spent in the history of our state by a state Senate candidate, and yet candidates on average were being outspent 6-1 by outside interest groups. So it was mostly these phony front groups that were doing all the advertising. They were doing all the talking. Voters barely heard from the candidates themselves.
And then afterwards, they send these wonderful thank yous for voting in the person they want. Prosser had one of those. But the interesting thing about having a public financing is that the people who are running, instead of having people who can afford to run, what you have are people who are everyday people, your housewives, your working class, the people of color, people who normally cannot run because they can't afford to do it, it's opening it up, and you're seeing, I know Arizona had it, I think Vermont also had it, and you're seeing those type of people run.
Yeah, and Maine was another great example. And that's exactly right. One of the things that has happened that I think is just a tragedy for our democracy is that most of the population has been priced out of the political marketplace. Most people can't even fathom, they can't even contemplate the idea of running for any kind of major public office because they know that they've got to have access to millions of dollars to compete. And so they've been priced out of the marketplace. And so the only people who can run are those who are either independently wealthy or willing to take a second mortgage out on their soul. And if they are willing to please the corporations and the wealthy interests who can flood all this money into campaigns, then they can run for office. And that's really the evil behind what I have called that unholy trinity of Supreme Court rulings. What they've done is said money talks, money can talk as much as it wants, money should do all the talking. And what that does is it does replace free speech with fee speech, and it does price people out of the marketplace and guarantee that only the instruments of plutocracy can possibly consider competing for public office. Well, that's what those 5 justices on the Supreme Court were put there to do. They were appointed to help usher in that kind of toll booth democracy, or you know, to use the fancier term, plutocracy. And that's what we all as citizens have to fight against. And it's going to be a long and it's going to be a very difficult battle. But I think we can take comfort from the fact that, you know, Wisconsin faced very comparable conditions during the Gilded Age in the late 1800s, and people with a lot less education than us, a lot less money than us, far fewer means of communication, they rose up against the same kinds of forces, the Carnegies, the Vanderbilts, the Rockefellers. Now it's the Koch brothers, and it's Howie Rich, and it's all the, you know, it's the modern day plutocrats that we're up against. But people rose up against it, and they defeated it back then. And if they could do it then, I absolutely have faith that we can do it again now.
Well, there's a movement against Citizens United. Would you consider Citizens United the one thing that we can target and kind of reverse? Do you think that's, of the three unholy trinity rulings, do you think that's the one that would make the most impact?
Well, you know, if you take on, and I think Citizens United finally woke people up. I was talking for years about the fundamental evil of Buckley versus Valeo, but yet people weren't really paying attention. They, you know, here you had the Supreme Court basically rewrite the First Amendment. The First Amendment is 45 words long. It doesn't say money is speech. It doesn't say corporations are people. You can't even find the word money or corporation anywhere in the First Amendment or in the entire Constitution, for that matter. Yet the U.S. Supreme Court took the First Amendment, which was 185 years old at the time, and basically rewrote it. And it really took the Citizens United ruling saying that corporations can engage in unlimited spending to wake people up to what was happening, what the Supreme Court was really doing to the First Amendment and to our democracy. And so if that can be the rallying point, if that can be what people can connect to and can be inspired to action by, then I'm all for focusing on Citizens United, because it is a fundamental evil. But it is part of a very elaborate and 30-year-long strategy to undermine democracy. There were some of us who are out there trying to talk about Buckley for a couple of decades, and we didn't gain the traction that we've been able to gain with Citizens United. So, you know, I'm all for we started a group called United Citizens Against Citizens United, and before we were talking about groups like Buck Buckley. But, you know, Citizens United certainly has created a spark, and people have jumped on this. And I think we have to ultimately look at amending the Constitution to undo the damage that's been done by the Supreme Court. But in the interim, we can push for disclosure. We can push for corporate accountability and shareholder rights. We can push for public financing. So I think there can be short-term efforts that can be tremendously helpful. Ultimately, the long term, I think you've got to look at continuing to push for a constitutional amendment overturning Citizens United, which at the same time would overturn Buckley. Get rid of the money is speech doctrine, get rid of the doctrine that corporations are people, and restore democracy, restore the meaning of the First Amendment as it was understood for nearly two centuries in this country.
Now, we just have a few more minutes left, but let's say that we get that constitutional amendment done. Let's say that all the money was taken out of the system, Citizens United was overturned. How would things be different?
Well, you know, if we could have a system where even 5% of the people paid for election campaigns, it would be a huge game changer. It would radically alter the political landscape. We don't need 50% of the people paying for elections. If we could just get from 1% to 5%, it would have a huge impact. What that would mean is, instead of relying on donations averaging $2,000 from the wealthiest 1% in our society, politicians would be relying on contributions of no more than $100 from citizens all across the country, and they would no longer be beholden to those narrow interests that they would then have to repay in the form of tax breaks, in the form of pork barrel spending, in the form of no bid contracts for government work. we could have wind energy move forward in Wisconsin. We could have passenger rail move forward in Wisconsin. It would no longer be blocked by the narrow interests that are selfishly served by policies that really hurt the state of Wisconsin as a whole, and that goes for the whole country. If we could just get to 5%, if we could have public policies that would incentivize small-dollar giving and create a powerful incentive for candidates to rely on those small donations through a public financing, public matches, we could revolutionize politics, and it would have a huge impact, and it would really put the R back in free speech, and it would allow people of ordinary means to run for public office again. A whole lot of good things would happen if we could just get to 5%. But that's going to take public policies that make it so, that push us in that direction. What's happened is we've got public policies and Supreme Court rulings that are taking us in the exact opposite direction.
And on that, I'm going to say thank you so much for being on the show today, Mike.
It was a pleasure, Sarah. Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it, and I hope we can do it again.
I was just going to say, we have to keep this conversation going. There was so much we didn't get to because there's so much to talk about with this. So we'll definitely have you back on again. Thank you so much. Have a great Labor Day weekend.
You too. Thanks again.
Thanks. That was Mike McCabe from the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. Their website is www.wisdc.org or www.wisdc.org, however you want to say it, just so you got it. Go there, see what they're about, follow them, help them out. Great group doing a lot of thankless work. Now, the Sarah Schultz Show is looking for sponsors and donations and or donations. If you're interested in sponsoring a show or donating to help the show keep going, please contact me at sarahschultzshow@gmail.com. I am going to do a plug for Citywide, LPFM 99.1. If you're in the Madison area, please turn them on and take a listen. They have some great shows. And in case you missed the announcement earlier, that now includes mine. Their website is www.citywidelpfm.org. And now it's time for the Progressive Voice with Matt Rothschild.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. This is how cold America has become. On Thursday, according to the New York Times, a dozen illegal immigrants suffering from kidney failure were refused treatment at a clinic in Atlanta. That's right, they couldn't get their dialysis. Basically, they were told to go home and wait until they're on death's doorstep before coming back, because then the clinic would be required to treat them. One of the immigrants from India said, "Trust me, it's just like dying when you don't get your dialysis. You're almost unconscious." Now, this would happen in no other advanced country in the world. In every other country, you'd get the regular dialysis treatment you needed, no matter who you were, and you wouldn't have to wait until it became a life-threatening emergency. The irony is that treating these immigrants on an emergency basis is likely to end up costing our healthcare system much more, since these patients with kidney failure may develop serious complications while they've been waiting for treatment, complications that would then require weeks of expensive hospitalization. But in our messed up healthcare system, that doesn't seem to matter, nor evidently does the suffering of the patients. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
Well, we're going to finish off the hour with Michelle Wheeler. She's from Bad River Watershed Association. She has been the director of Bad River Watershed Association and involved with it since 2004. First as a board member, then she became the first paid staff member as the director in 2007. She has a bachelor's in science and environmental resource management and a master's in fisheries, restoration, and monitoring. So welcome to the show today, Michelle.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks for being on. First, can you talk a little bit about who Bad River Watershed Association is and a little bit about what you guys do?
Yeah, we are a nonprofit citizens group. As you mentioned, we were founded in 2002, and our group works to involve all citizens in learning about and caring for the watershed that we live in. We realize that it's in our area, the individual decisions of people that live here that are going to influence the way that our rivers look like in the future. And so our group works to really cast a wide net and work with everyone who lives in our area to to take care of the place that we all care a lot about.
Well, why should we and the rest of the state be concerned about what's going on with the waterways up in northern Wisconsin?
Yeah, well, the big news in our area, we're, you know, pretty used to actually not getting a whole lot of attention from the rest of the states, but lately we've been getting a lot of attention, and that's because of some significant interest in open pit mining. And that interest in developing a mine has also been accompanied by some interest in changing the mining laws for the entire state. For those of your listeners that don't know much about our area, the Pinoki Hills, or Gogebic Range, runs through the headwaters of our watershed. And this is a really long kind of string of hills that have a lot of iron in them, and runs from over into Michigan all the way over to Grandview in our area. But the area of interest is about 22 miles long. It's primarily owned by a couple of mining companies, LaPointe and RGGS. Together they own about 22,000 acres of land, and now have enlisted a developer, the Klein Group, based out of Florida, who's established a small LLC called Gogebic Taconite to work to develop this mine in our area. And so, you know, there's kind of a couple things. One is the development of the mine brings with it a lot of risk to water resources in our area, and so we're really thoughtful about what that change could mean for us. By the mining process itself, the infrastructure that's developed, groundwater implications as well, surface water implications. But the big thing right now is that the Walker administration has made changing the mining laws a priority. So we anticipate that we're going to see some proposals to change the mining law in the fall.
Right, and just to let people know, if you have any questions for Michelle, you can call in at 310-742-1896. Or 877-497-1797. Now, what are some of the other natural resources in the Pinoki Mountain Range? You talked about the headwaters. What else is there?
Yeah. The area in the Pinoki Range where there's some interest in mining, a lot of the streams that run off that area have been designated as exceptional or outstanding resource waters. And just to talk a little bit about what that means, the Clean Water Act is federal legislation that works to protect the waters of the U.S., and the Clean Water Act delegates authority to implement that law to the states. And what the state of Wisconsin does is first starts with designating water bodies for their use. So they assign a designated use to each water body in the state. And that could be this is a cold water stream, or it's a warm water stream, or it supports limited aquatic life, or it's an exceptional or outstanding resource water. And those designations are reserved for streams that have the highest quality water. They provide outstanding recreational opportunities. They support valuable fisheries and wildlife habitats. So these are, you know, they're not common places. They've earned this special designation because they're such high quality waters. And there's a lot of them that run off the Pinoki Range, including the Tyler Forks River, the Potato River, Brunsweiler as outstanding resource waters, and a lot of exceptional resource waters as well. So some really pretty special places in the streams that run off the Pinokis. But in addition, there's a lot of really significant wetland areas, and those wetlands are important in their own right for the habitat that they provide for the species that depend on them, like wood turtles and rare plants and migratory birds. So, you know, a lot of those wetlands provide some really special habitat for the critters that depend on them. But also those wetlands have a really strong connection to stream systems as well. The wetlands are kind of like a sponge on the landscape. And so if you think about when we get sort of some high rain events, it's the wetlands that are helping those streams not flood so much because the wetlands hold back that water. And in kind of a similar way, when we get into some dry periods, those wetlands are kind of releasing that water slowly. So the wetlands are really closely tied to the streams, and they prevent the water from getting too high and causing floods, and they prevent the water from getting too low and causing droughts. And there's a lot of them in that area. The other thing that's really significant, in particular when you're thinking about taconite mining, is the groundwater in the area. And again, the groundwater resources are intricately tied to the surface water streams and also the wetlands. And taconite mining is extremely water intensive, and it's one of the things that, you know, the mining companies themselves have said that where to get the water for the taconite processing is to them one of their major challenges. And to us, it makes us think, well, what happens when you start sucking a lot of water out of the ground or from surface water. I mean, there's some real concerns about what will happen to the rivers that we depend on, to the groundwater that we all depend on, and to the wetlands that depend on that water as well. One of the wetlands, I mentioned wetlands a little bit, but one of the places that one of the most important wetlands in our area is the Bad River and Skagen Sloughs that's at the mouth of the Bad River on Lake Superior, on the reservation of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. And this is the largest undeveloped wetland complex in the upper Great Lakes. It has an enormous amount of regional significance for the ecological value that it provides. But in addition, the sloughs have some real substantial cultural significance to the Bad River tribe. The sloughs support the largest natural wild rice bed in the Great Lakes Basin. That, you know, the migration stories of the Bad River tribe include, you know, go to the place where food grows on water. And so the sloughs and the wild rice bed there are they're an enormously important place. And how this project would affect the sloughs is a big question as well. The sloughs also support a lot of threatened and endangered species, such as trumpeter swan and bald eagle and piping plover, wood turtle, some rare orchid species. So there's, you know, we're in an area that, you know, although I wouldn't say pristine, has some really high-quality resources. And the change that mining would bring to our area, it would be huge. I mean, it would be enormous. This is the largest iron ore reserve left in the country. And, you know, there's been a long history of mining in the area. Mining started in the area back in the 1880s. There's only been one taconite mine in Wisconsin. That's down near Black River Falls, Lake Oisille. But the scale of this is, you know, this is not the mines that we've seen in the past. This is an enormous operation. So we're really thoughtful about the change that the mining operation itself would bring, but the big question right now is the change in legislation that there is some significant interest in. And so we're really focusing on that right now.
Going back to the wetlands for a second, I know you spoke a lot about them. I've heard them be described as the kidneys of the area, where the water goes in, they clean it out, and then they send it out. So
yep.
having that
yep.
destroyed could really damage the way the entire system just works.
Yeah, exactly. That's a really good point. I talked about wetlands and the role that they play primarily in moderating water levels, but also the role that they play in terms of water quality is just as you described it. They're like the kidneys on the landscape. And so when you have the destruction of wetlands limits the ability of the whole area to be resilient to change too. You know, so you tax it in one way by having big development, and then you take away if you fill in those wetlands and get rid of them, you're also taking away the ability of the system to recover. And so, yeah, that's a great point.
Now, have you heard anything about the mine that they're proposing it up in that area in the Pinoki Mountain Range?
There is not a proposal, or the mining company hasn't started the process, the permitting process. To our understanding, what has been done is they've applied for some boring permits, which is essentially kind of, you know, digging a hole down into the rock to see kind of what quantity of iron there is and learn more about the rock itself. They applied for a permit for, I believe it was about 7 or 8 sites, and to our knowledge, haven't started the drilling for that. They have put in, when I talked to the DNR last, it was 4 groundwater testing wells, and there is not a permit that's required to do that. They need to abide by the law in the way that they put in the groundwater testing wells, and they are, you know, free to do that and free to pull information from those wells. If they want to use that as part of the permitting process, they need to file under the existing law a notice of intent, and they have not done that yet. So there's no plan out there. There's no described sort of, you know, there's no description of what they intend to do. But in general, they have been talking about how they would mine this in general. It would be from what we understand right now, it would be an open pit mine. So the forest would be cleared to you know, start digging, and there'd be about a half a mile wide by 4 mile long open pit. And there'd be, you know, additional clearing for infrastructure of the mine. So in general, they would clear off the forest, and then they would blast and haul out the rock in big trucks. This project also would call for on-site processing, which is different than what we've seen in this area in terms of the history of mining. You know, there hasn't been the taconite mining with on-site processing. And it's the processing that is super water consumptive. So what they do is they pull this rock out and they crush it into smaller and smaller pieces of rock until it's eventually like the consistency of face powder, really fine particles of rock. And then they would use a lot of water. This is where the water consumption comes in. They use a lot of water to float this crushed up material and get a great big magnet to remove the iron from the other stuff. It's magnetite and then you know, also some quartz, which doesn't contain iron. So they're looking to pull that iron out. They call it beneficiation. It means makes it more beneficial, makes it more concentrated of iron. And then once you pull the iron out, you got to figure out what to do with all that other stuff. Over in the Mesabi Range, there's tailing ponds that are used to kind of settle out that material. So they you know, essentially like build a big pond and throw all that stuff in there, and the particulate matter settles to the bottom with the idea being that it filters out any of the pollutants. And what they're thinking about doing here is instead to squeeze all the water out of those out of the tailings and put them into a great big pile. So, you know, again, the taconite mining is different than what has been done in our area. There was a taconite mine down in the Black River Falls area, closed down in, I believe, 86. The scale of the project that's being proposed up here is very different from what's being than what happened in Black River Falls. I've seen a couple of different sources that said that the Black River Falls taconite mine, while it was in operation, I think they produced anywhere between 300,000 and 850,000 tons of taconite pellets a year. And in this mine, they're talking about 7 to 8 million tons of taconite pellets a year. And so a lot of material produced, but an enormous amount of tailings that needs to be put somewhere. And so the scale of this project is just enormous, which really, you know, this is a project that could last for 35, 50, 100 years. And that's after they dig down to about 1,000 feet. As comparison, Black River Falls is about 350 feet deep. This one, you know, they could dig down to 1,000 feet. And so it's huge. And so our big concern is when you start messing with the legislative process on the brink of a project that could be this enormous, you really need to be cautious and careful about being thorough and being really thoughtful and understanding the changes that are being proposed to any sort of mining law. It's kind of like anybody who's a parent or worked with kids, you know, you set up your rules, right? That would be like the law. And what do kids do? The first thing they do is they push on it. They try to get over it. They try to get around it. And that's what, you know, our mining law needs to be a strong law that doesn't have loopholes. Because if we, you know, if we end up with a law that is not a strong law, we could end up with you know, jobs for some at the expense of enough clean water for others, and we don't want to end up there.
Now, I'm going to get to the law in a second. We don't have a lot of time, and there's a couple things I really want to get to. But basically, what you're telling me with the mine is that you're going to start out with mountains and end up with a lake. That's basically the scope of what we're talking about.
Yeah. You start out with mountains and you end up with a lake, but the tailing piles could create new mountains elsewhere because it's an enormous amount of material. I mean, it's a few square miles higher than any hill that we have right now. I mean, it's an enormous amount of material.
Wow. Well, you just
Wow.
Wow. So you're actually removing it, moving the mountains, causing a lake, and creating an entire new environment.
Yeah, I mean it's going to be a completely changed area. It'll be an industrial landscape for 100 years, and then you know it will never go back to the way it was, and that's what's so concerning about changing the law when we're at the forefront of this. It's, you know, I mean, there's enough to figure out in kind of interpreting our existing law and really making sure that we understand where the walls are, where the regulations are in that law. And so, you know, what we saw in the spring was this hurry-up process for a lot of legislation, and it was the case for a couple of attempts to push through mining legislation as well. That's really concerning. And so that's why the Watershed Association has started this petition to petition the legislature to maintain the environmental provisions in the existing mining law. We think that that's really important to do, and to do now, because when the session starts in, say, the middle of September, if spring is any indication, we could see something that comes out and they're asking for a vote on it, shortly thereafter, and that to our community is really interesting.
All right, and we're about out of time, so I have to leave it there. What's your website address so people can get to it?
Yeah, it's badriverwatershed.org.
Okay.
And folks can go there, check it out, and give me a call if you have any questions. This is certainly a statewide issue. We're looking for statewide signatures to our petition. So I'd encourage folks to go there and help us spread the word.
All right. Go there, sign the petition, and thank you so much for listening to the Sarah Schultz Show today. Have a great week. Listen for us tonight, 6:30 to 8 p.m. on Wide Citywide FM LP 99.1.
Order, 14 senators, capital disorder, 14 senators, new Wisconsin heroes. What's the score? Senators 14, Governor Walker 0. What's the score? Senators 14, Governor Walker 0. Governor 0.